Matthew chapter 8, and our text is going to be verses 5 through 13, but I want to go ahead and back up and start at verse 1 because this is immediately after the Sermon on the Mount. We dealt with verses 1 through 4 last week, but let's read them again. When he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him, and behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Then Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, "I am willing, be cleansed." Immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you tell no one, but go your way, show yourself to the priests, and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." The centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, this one, go, and he goes. To another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in..." There was a while where my children liked to play a game called Would You Rather. The idea of the game is to give two hypothetical questions in order to make you think about, and it sort of spurs discussion about, your preference between two things. So would you rather have more time, or would you rather have more money? Would you rather be able to speak all foreign languages, or be able to speak to all animals? Invariably, one of my kids would make the game take an ugly turn and say, "Well, would you rather get an eye put out or a hand cut off? Would you rather spend 5 years in prison or 10 years in a coma?" Reading the first 13 verses of Matthew chapter 8 make me think of a would you rather question that I would love to be able to go back and ask some first century Jews. Would you rather touch a leper or go to a Roman centurion's house? And as strange as it seems to our minds, that's probably a question they would have a difficult time answering. The first event Matthew records after the Sermon on the Mount was the healing of the leper in verses 1 through 4. Messiah King Jesus proves his power and authority, as well as his compassion and his purity. The most dreaded disease of the ancient world proves no test to the power and authority of Jesus. The most defiled exile from society, the unclean leper who would instantly make others unclean if they touched him, was not so defiled that the compassion and purity of Jesus couldn't prevail. The second event Matthew records takes that same truth to another extreme. I really don't think that we've got the cultural instincts necessary to grasp just how unclean a Gentile was in the Jewish mindset. Going into a Gentile's home was unthinkable because you would become ritually defiled in the process, just as if you had touched a leper. And add to that, that the Gentile in question is an officer in the enemy occupying army of your country, you might just choose hanging out with the leper. But Messiah King Jesus proves his power and authority extends beyond the reach of even the Roman Empire. By his gracious interaction with this centurion, Jesus makes it clear he's not only able to reach the most defiled, he is willing to graciously interact with them and welcome them into his kingdom. Our text begins with a personal appeal starting at verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, the centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." And Jesus said, "I will come and heal him." Now, I want us to have a good mental picture of what happens on this day as best we can. So I would like you to leave a bookmark here, but look at Luke chapter 7 and see Luke's accounts of this interaction. Much has been made of the fact that Luke does not record the details the same way that Matthew records the details. And so part of what I want to do is address that concern so that you can see how these two accounts harmonize with one another. Luke chapter 7. In Luke 6, we get the Sermon on the Plain, which is Luke's account of the Sermon on the Mount. He just said they went up the mountain to a plateau, and that's where Jesus preached. And then he says in chapter 7, "Now when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum, and a certain centurion's servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent the elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them, and when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, 'Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you, but say the word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it.' When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, 'I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel.' And those who were sent, returning to the house, found the servant well who had been sick." Now, this is obviously the same story. Luke says it's when Jesus concluded these sayings. So right after the Sermon on the Mount, both agree that his first real destination was returning to Capernaum, somewhere nearby, possibly in the city of Capernaum itself. A Roman centurion's home was in turmoil because in that home was this sick youth. Now, a centurion is an officer in the Roman army. He commands, originally a centurion commanded 100 men, hence the name centurion. Now, if you're curious, the next officer level up was a prefect, and then a tribune, and then a legate, and it goes on up. Roman military structure was incredibly complicated. There was up to 100, well, actually more than 100 different ranks that could be held. And that's going to be important later on in the story. Maybe the closest modern comparison to a Roman centurion is roughly equal to a captain in our military. Now, at this point in this event, it's been less than 100 years since a Roman general named Pompey had conquered Judea. And there is this long-running, deep-seated hatred for Rome. Roman centurions, in the Jewish mind, they were not the good guys. That being said, oddly enough, every centurion we read about in the New Testament is mentioned in a relatively good light at times. So there's this centurion of Capernaum and his faith. The next is the centurion who was in charge of the crucifixion. And we don't even know he's there until he makes that statement, "Truly, this was the Son of God." We have Cornelius in Caesarea, who hears the gospel and is baptized. Another centurion has Paul arrested and is going to have him beaten, but hears about his Roman citizenship and instead protects him. Then there's a couple of more who protect Paul from the hostile crowd in Jerusalem. The final centurion in the New Testament is a man named Julius, and he's commanding the soldiers on a ship that's taking Paul to Rome, and it says that he befriends Paul and listens to his advice. And so I'm just telling you all that to say, when Rome is the occupying enemy army, having seven different centurions mentioned in the New Testament, all with positive statements about them, is downright odd. And this centurion is even particularly odd, if for no other reason than how he cares for his servant. Luke calls this sick youth in his house a doulos, and that's a word that means slave. Matthew uses the word for pais, and it means a young servant. And so it was not unusual in those days for a child to be sold or find himself in servitude, and he would have no rights whatsoever. By law, he was nothing more than property to be disposed of. And so it speaks well of this centurion's character that this boy was not considered as merely replaceable property. In fact, Luke says this servant was dear to him. He was precious. He was held in honor. And while he's held in honor, he's also in tremendous pain. It's difficult to guess what exactly is wrong with this child. Interestingly enough, Luke, being a doctor, would be the one who would venture a guess for us. But he just says that this child was sick and ready to die. Matthew's the one who adds the details that he is paralyzed and dreadfully tormented. That is, he's immobile. He's suffering terribly. And yet somehow the word of Jesus' ministry gets to this Roman centurion. It's possible that it was just his job to sort of keep his finger on the pulse of the community, and so Jesus had his attention already. It's possible that as all the doctors failed to help this servant, that someone finally came to him, kind of like the story of Naaman the leper back in the Old Testament, where there was a servant that says, look, maybe you want to go to this man of God. There may have been personal interaction prior to this, because Jesus had already been in and around Capernaum quite a bit. However he heard of Jesus, this Roman centurion comes to him. Or did he? That's really the point between Matthew and Luke that gets a little confusing. The most striking difference between Matthew and Luke's account is that back in Matthew chapter 8, verse 5, Matthew describes the centurion coming to him. And in Luke's account, Luke says that the centurion in verse 3 sent elders to him, and later on in verse 6 sends friends to him. Now we understand both Matthew and Luke are correct. And so there's a couple of ways of reconciling this. The first possibility is Matthew is just giving us a shortened record of the interaction between Jesus and this centurion. If you ever picked up a newspaper and read a story about the U.S. president talking to the leader in Russia, you would understand instinctively there were some people between that. But you don't talk about all the go-betweens. You just talk about the two who are actually communicating. And maybe that's how Matthew has recorded this. Similarly, even though Luke describes these elders and later on friends of the centurion coming to Jesus, he also describes this basically as just direct interaction between Jesus and the centurion. They're speaking with each other. Because what you do through others counts as if you did it yourself. We even see that in another place in this story. When the elders come and say, he has built us a synagogue. Do you picture the Roman centurion out there banging away at rocks and mortar, building them a synagogue? Or do you understand, oh, he did it, he gets the credit for it, but he did it through the use of others? Similarly, when Matthew talks about the Roman centurion coming to Jesus, he did it through others, likely. Maybe we could reconcile this by saying all three versions of Jesus and the centurion's interaction happened just exactly the way Luke and Matthew say. So that the centurion sent elders, and as Jesus is coming to the house, the centurion sends friends, and as Jesus gets very close to the house, the centurion comes out himself. The interesting part to me is why he would send elders to go to Jesus. When the elders come to Jesus appealing on the centurion's behalf, as you read in Luke, do you think that they do a good job? Look at verse 4 and 5 again in Luke chapter 7. When they come to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. First off, let's just pause for a second and say how strange this situation is. What is going through the mind of the Jewish elders of the synagogue, people who are generally not friendly with Jesus, being sent to talk to Jesus on behalf of a Roman army officer, someone whom they're typically not friendly with? What a strange position for them to be in. And so they go on his behalf and they talk to Jesus, and we look at it and go, well, how did they do? Well, from a human standpoint, it seems like they've nailed it. But from a spiritual perspective, think about this. Jesus, you should help this man because he is so worthy. You have to be merciful and gracious to him because he deserves it. What a lousy way to approach the Lord of glory. And for what it's worth, I think the centurion thinks that exact same way. He knows that that is not the way to approach Jesus. I really wonder if he anticipated this is the way they would come to Jesus when he sent the elders to him. Because at some point, word gets back to the house and he seems appalled by what he hears. Like, can you picture a messenger coming down the road and saying, Captain, I just want you to know the elders have made it to Jesus, and boy, they are really bragging about you. They are talking you up, and Jesus is on his way. That is not what this centurion wanted. In fact, if he spent some time dealing with the Jewish leadership, he may well suspect in the back of his mind that they would love for Jesus to step inside of a Gentile's house so they would have some reason to accuse him of becoming defiled. So he sends further word. He sends friends and maybe ultimately goes himself. And the message changes from the elders saying, oh, you've got to do this because he's so deserving, to what's the message changed to? Lord, I am not worthy that you should come to my roof. Luke tells us that he even sent word saying, look, I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you personally. Don't listen to those guys telling you how worthy I am. I know I'm not. Matthew, in our text in Matthew 8, cuts through all of the go-between and simply says this. Verse 5, Jesus entered Capernaum. A centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said, I will come and heal him. Jesus is perfectly willing to enter into this man's home because of his compassion toward this army officer and toward the poor child servant that's back at the house. I will come and heal him. And if the healing, if the touch of a leper is not going to defile Jesus, going into a Gentile's house is not going to defile him either. But it's the centurion who resists this on behalf of Jesus. And so we see that personal appeal in verses 5 through 7. And then there's a profound understanding here that's displayed starting at verse 8. The centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed." Continually refers to himself as unworthy. Specifically, unworthy to have Jesus in his home. Luke describes it unworthy to be in the very presence of Jesus. That is a distinction that very few Gentiles of the day would have made or even understood. He is expressing some faith beyond what is visible. So imagine a Roman army officer who could command anyone in the region just by his word, and yet he's sending messengers because he doesn't consider himself worthy to be in Jesus' presence. Even more than that, he is confident in the ability of Jesus to heal this servant without even being in the presence of the child. Neither Matthew in his gospel nor Luke in his gospel sort of prepares the reader for this kind of healing. What is it that enables this desperate man to know that Jesus can help and yet not demand his presence to help? And the answer seems to be that he has really real faith in Jesus' authority. And to prove that, he makes a profound statement about Jesus' authority. Look at verses 9 and 10. Matthew 8, 9 and 10. "For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." Here's the centurion's point. It is not necessary for Jesus to tarnish his own reputation in the eyes of the Jews or the Jewish leadership by entering into a Gentile's house, because he has authority from God even in those places where he is not physically present. Maybe the two most important words for us to consider in this text are the words "also" and "under." We know from Luke's account, the centurion seems unimpressed by the elder's attempts to like promote his greatness. "You've got to come help him. He's so great. He's so worthy. He does wonderful things." He sends this message to say, "No, I'm not worthy. I am a man under authority." He does not say, "I am a man of authority. I am a man with authority. I'm a man under authority." As a Roman officer, you have to know his idea of authority comes with a certain amount of military precision. I said earlier, all those complicated ranks in the Roman army are kind of helpful to the story. Here's where that happens. This centurion says, "I am under authority," but he goes on to explain in verse 9, "I have soldiers under me." And so his idea of authority is about, well, where he fits in the chain of authority, right? It's he has people to whom he has to submit, those who are over him, and he has people who submit to him, those who are under him. His idea of authority is authority flows downward like water. I say go, they go. I say come, they come. I say do this, they do it. In other words, the way we would say it today, I say jump, they say how high. But his ability to make those commands and his description is not about himself. It's because he is a man under authority. It's because of the authority that's over him. He answers to a prefect, and the prefect answers to a general, and a general answers to the governor, and the governor ultimately answers to Caesar. By the way, where is Caesar? He's in Rome. He's nowhere near here, right? Does Caesar have to be present in Caesarea for his authority to be felt there? In the centurion's estimation, the nature of authority is as it flows downward to the execution of its purpose. Even though the one representing the ultimate power is not present. Now, why does that matter? Because of the word also. Look at the text. I also am a man under authority. What the centurion knows is true of himself. He also says, look, I know this is true of Jesus too. In other words, I know your authority is like this. And he's right. Jesus is a man under authority. Jesus consistently says throughout the Gospels, I have not come to do my own will. I've come to do the will of him that sent me. I've come to do the will of the Father. Father, not my will, but yours be done. He is submitted to the authority of the Father. And the centurion seems to understand this and speaks to Jesus as if the authority extends far beyond the realm of physical things. So think about this comparison, right? They're in Caesarea. Caesarea is Roman domain. It is occupied by the Roman army. Caesar is not there in Caesarea. He would not want to be. But he doesn't have to be there for his authority to be there. And the centurion says, look, I'm the one who ultimately is sent here by Caesar to carry out his will and to bear his authority in this place. But, all of this, even my house, is God's domain. Yahweh, who is the creator of heaven and earth, is the one who has authority here. And you, Jesus, you are the one sent by God to carry out his will and bear his authority. And his authority, and therefore your authority, extends to all places. You don't have to be at my house. My house is already yours, Lord. Would you please just give the command, and I know my servant will be healed. I mean, if this was an issue of brute force, then the authority of Caesar would be enough, but the power of Jesus extends beyond what even Rome could do. If Jesus proved his power and authority in healing the leper, how much more is he going to prove his power and authority over all the earth by showing mercy to this mighty Roman officer even without needing to be present? This is the kind of faith that honors the Lord Jesus. And Jesus, verse 10 says, marveled at it. Not just the existence of that faith, but the source of it. Instead of coming from any well-learned religious Jew, it comes from a Roman army officer. And Jesus marvels and says, I haven't seen faith this great, not even in Israel. Now let's be clear about the nature of this great faith. It is obvious that Jesus is not just lauding the quantity of this man's faith. When he talks about this man's great faith, he's not saying, look at how much faith this man has. Jesus is commending the quality of this man's faith. At this point in his ministry, there were plenty of people who would have been completely confident in Jesus' ability to heal that man's servant. Doubtless there were people who might even have thought, yeah, Jesus can do that without even being at the house. But the centurion's faith is not about what Jesus could do. The greatness of the centurion's faith is seeing why it is that Jesus could do it. He has authority that extends all over the world. And so in verses 5 through 7, the centurion makes that personal appeal. In verses 8 through 10, he gives this profound understanding. And Jesus takes that in verses 11 through 13 to make public application. I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, Go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. As all of this unfolded, there were probably mixed feelings among the Jewish onlookers. Some of them would have been happy to know that this man's little servant would be healed. Many were probably undoubtedly frustrated about Jesus' willingness to in any way interact with a Gentile, much less a Roman officer. But all of them would have fallen into this faulty thinking that this event was somehow an exception. They would have seen this going on and went, well, how strange is this little interruption to Jesus' ministry? Let's get this exception over and get the show back on the road. Jesus won't let that go. Verse 10 says, he said to those who followed. Luke says he literally turned around and talked to the crowd following him. This is no one-time event. Many people from many places will experience similar faith. Jesus says many will come from the east and from the west. Now remember, Matthew's focus is to reveal Jesus as the Messiah King, and so he records this event for this teaching. The kingdom of Messiah King Jesus is going to welcome plenty of outsiders, and in the process, many apparent insiders are going to be excluded. Many from outside the nation of Israel are going to be part of the kingdom of Christ, while many within Israel, certain that they must be part of the kingdom, are going to be cast into hell, Jesus says. Interestingly enough, hell here is not used as a tactic to frighten those people who aren't right with God. It's used as a reality to warn those people who think that they are right with God. You aren't right with God unless you believe in the one who he sent to save. You're not right with God unless you are submitting to the authority of Messiah King Jesus. And so listen, I'm glad, I don't want to overlook it, I'm glad Matthew includes the end of verse 13, his servant was healed that same hour. But when you read all this story, you realize Matthew includes that almost like an afterthought. The actual healing of this servant is not the point of this story. The focus is on the centurion and on his faith in Jesus and on that what that means for people who are trusting something other than faith in Jesus to secure them a place in his kingdom. And so in verses 11 through 13, he shows that his kingdom is the very fulfillment of God's ancient promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. But not one of those Jewish folks should think for a moment that just proving themselves to be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is going to secure them a seat at the table. It doesn't. They'll be left out. You know who will be sitting there? Apparently a Roman centurion who trusted Jesus and was confident this man possessed power and authority unlike any other, even beyond the ability of Rome itself to duplicate. And you then should not think for a moment that your position as, well, look, I'm from a religious family. I am a citizen of a Christian nation. Do not think that that is going to secure you anything. Nothing short of submitting yourself to Jesus' authority will do. Nothing other than genuine faith in Jesus secures a place in his kingdom. You can go to Sunday school and Wednesday night services and learn the commandments and regurgitate all of your memory verses, but do you have faith in Jesus? You can be morally upright and promote traditional values and help old folks across the street and like puppies and kittens, and all of that will make you a good person to be around, but it doesn't mean you're going to be around the kingdom of Christ. There's going to be plenty of seemingly nice people who Jesus says are weeping and grinding teeth in outer darkness. You can be a flag-waving, pro-life, conservative Republican. That might help this kingdom, but it's not going to make you a part of Christ's kingdom unless you submit to his authority and come to him in faith. If the seemingly good, apparently upright, well-positioned folks from the right family don't have a reserved seat in Christ's kingdom, then who can have one? Apparently a leper. Someone so dangerously defiled that no one would dare stand near him. You can have a Roman centurion, someone considered so utterly unclean that entering into his house would have been unthinkable. But by his gracious interaction with this centurion, Jesus makes clear he's not only able to reach the most defiled, he is willing to graciously interact with them and welcome them into his kingdom. If they, like this centurion, will confess their own unworthiness, will trust his authority and appeal to nothing but the mercy and grace of Jesus alone.